Now, our first guest today has had a career that spanned more than 30 years and five different bases. We're going to be talking about her latest book called Grounded. Welcome to the show, Emma Henderson, MBE. Welcome to the show, Emma.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Now, I want to ask you about your MBE later, but we're talking about flying, aren't we? So what got you into flying? Are you from a flying family?
I'm not from a flying family, actually, no. I'm from, my mum was a teacher, my dad's an insurance broker, and nobody in my family has ever flown a plane before, or since, actually. And I think I just had this fascination with everything that flew from a young age. I loved birds and kites and hot air balloons and things like that, but I remember when I was 10 years old seeing Space Shuttle Enterprise come into Stansted on the back of a 747. And it was a huge thing at the time. Thousands of people turned out to go and see the space shuttle. You could go to Stansted Airport and actually get quite up close to the aircraft. And I just looked up and saw this space shuttle on the back of the 747 and thought, I want to fly that. And I didn't mean the 747. I wanted to go into space and be an astronaut. But, you know, I was a 10-year-old girl growing up in rural Essex. I didn't know anything about flying. I didn't even know there's an air cadet in my local town. And I didn't think I could do it because, you know, I was a girl and I wasn't American. I thought you'd have to be American to be an astronaut.
Yeah.
So I kind of... Yeah, I still had the fascination growing as I grew up. You know, I read everything I could that had flying related references in it, and begged my parents. I must have pestered them because when I was 18, they bought me a flying lesson.
Oh.
And I landed from that lesson at Earl's Colne Airfield in Essex. And I said to my dad, this is it. I want to learn to fly. And he said, well, darling, you'll have to save up the money for the lessons because I can't afford to pay for it.
And did you do that then? Is that how you got into it? Because it was the RAF first, wasn't it?
It was the RAF first. So, yeah, no, I didn't. That's not the end of the story, really, because, you know, it was expensive to learn to fly even then. It still is. And I then decided I was going to go off to university. If I couldn't be a pilot, I thought I'd go and be a lawyer. And I wanted to be a corporate lawyer with a big fancy office in London. And that's so I went to university to do a history degree with a view to then doing a law conversion. And I did that at Leeds. And while I was there, I saw a big sign in Freshers Week saying, learn to fly for free. And I thought, I have to go and check this out. And it was the University Air Squadron, Yorkshire University's Air Squadron. And they were recruiting. And it was only the second year that they had allowed girls to join and fly in the Air Force. So it was quite a new thing to have girls on the squadron. And they just loved it. I went over and said, what's this all about then? And they recruited me on the spot. And I spent the next 2 years at RAF Finningley, which is now Doncaster Airport, learning to fly in a little training aircraft called a Bulldog. And my new plan was then to join the Air Force. But as we all know, all the best plans that you make never really work how you think they're going to. And on my first Friday night down at RAF Finningley for a training session, I went into the mess bar and met a bunch of guys that I'd met one of them at a party previously, and he introduced me to all his friends, and one of them is the man I've now been married to for 29 years.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. But as far as the flying's concerned in the RAF, did you get through all the training and pass all the exams and do it?
So I spent 70 hours flying Bulldogs around Yorkshire, and I went first solo and I went through that training syllabus, but I didn't end up joining the Air Force because I went for what they call aptitude tests at RAF Cranwell, and they said that I would make an exceptional navigator, but a marginal pilot, and I didn't want to be a navigator. I wanted to be a pilot. And in the meantime, my husband, Jim, had proposed 6 months after we met, and a year later we got married, which was 11 days after I graduated, and we moved up to the north of Scotland, where I live now. And I basically put my flying dreams to bed because I thought, well, I'm an Air Force wife now. I'm not, you know, I can't be an Air Force wife and have a career.
Oh, no.
it was different times then. We didn't communicate in the same way as we do now, and we didn't have the same ideas. You know, people were just starting to sort of open up their minds to the fact that you can do anything that you want to do. And, you know, I was very unusual because I got married at 22. All my friends went off and had careers. I got married and moved into this new Air Force world, had three babies, built a house, and then we moved to New Zealand a year after we moved into the house. And that's what changed my life, really, because it was in New Zealand that I had turned up as a very overweight, having had three babies in 3 years, smoking, non-exercising, you know, very unfit person. And New Zealand changed my life because I came back as a non-smoking triathlete and commercial pilot. So that 3.5 years was incredibly transformational.
Yeah, it sounds like New Zealand's the place to be.
Well, it was a very different environment. It was like home from home in some ways because we'd moved from the north of Scotland to New Zealand, and even the landscape is similar. And yeah, they drive on the left, they speak English. It felt like a very homely, welcoming place. Everybody was really friendly, but everybody ran or swam or had competed for New Zealand in some sport or other. Everyone that we met, and it was really interesting because when I first started training for a triathlon, my friends at home said to me, "What on earth do you want to do that for?" My friends in New Zealand said, "What time does the swim start? We'll come and cheer you on." It was just a completely different way of thinking about things.
Yeah, the only difference, I guess, between Scotland and New Zealand is the weather.
Well, you'd think, wouldn't you? But actually, where we live in this particular part of Scotland, we have our own little microclimate. We call it the Murray Riviera. And, you know, today is beautiful sunshine, 20 degrees, sitting outside in shorts until I came in to speak to you.
Oh, lovely.
It's a really beautiful day. And actually, it's very wet in New Zealand. It's known as, you know, Aotearoa is the land of the long white cloud. And it's subtropical. So I've never seen rain like it when I lived there, to be honest with you.
So you came back to Scotland, and I know you said you went into commercial airline. You worked for EasyJet, I believe, didn't you?
I did. I came back and I actually was a flying instructor for 3 years, and then I got a lucky break because EasyJet were recruiting. They took 10 recruits who already had licenses and were flying, and I was one of the 10. And we went through our training and I started working at Stansted, which was where it had all begun when I was 10 years old. So that was fantastic. And I spent 5 years working at Stansted. I moved to Luton for 4 years there and then finished my career at Gatwick. Didn't know I was going to finish my career. But in the meantime, I also, when Lyon opened as a base, we got sent out there. So we used to crew Lyon. So I spent a lot of time in France. And there was also an opportunity to go and work in Porto one summer. So I did that. And it was an amazing, I can't believe even now that I had that as my career.
Yeah. Captain, it's fantastic. Captain of EasyJet. You mentioned you finished at Gatwick and you weren't expecting it. Why did you finish then?
Well, COVID came along.
Ah, and yes, of course.
I was living, where I do now. My nearest airport is Inverness, which is why I had moved to Gatwick, because there was the most flights a day to get home. I'd moved to Inverness. All flights stopped. And I didn't know as I walked away from that aircraft on the last flight I operated that was the last flight I would ever operate commercially for EasyJet. It may not be the last flight I ever operate commercially. Who knows?
Watch this space.
I've still got another 14 flying years in me if I want to. But for the time being, that's what happened. And, you know, flights stopped. So that made it difficult to get to and from work anyway, even when flights started again, because they didn't just start everything up in one go. It's a 14-hour drive, which is obviously silly. And at the same time, my husband is vulnerable, or he has diabetes, and he was shielding all the way through lockdown. So I needed to protect him, and that was not made terribly easy by the options that I had to go back to work. And I set up a charity called Project Wingman during the pandemic that I was running, and it's still running now. And it gave me a different focus. It shifted my priorities, and I was running Wingman. It took a lot of my time, and I just voluntary redundancy was offered from the airline. And I thought, actually, do you know what? I think I'm done. I think I need to have a break, because I'd spent 12 years getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to go to work, or not coming back until 3 o'clock in the morning. So lockdown gave me an opportunity to sleep properly.
Yeah. And also, presumably before lockdown, you mentioned you had 3 children, you got a husband, you're running a home, and you were working as quite a high level job as well.
Yeah, there was a lot of pressure, and it was a pressure that I was willing to carry. You know, we made sacrifices, of course we did, for us both to have careers. So you can't have a military husband and an airline pilot wife and be at home all the time for your 3 children. So one of the things we did was put the children into boarding school, which was something I never had wanted to do, but it was the only way we could have both of the things we wanted to do. And there was a lot of pressure, and the weight of responsibility of having those 4 stripes on your shoulder, that means that you're responsible for the aircraft and everybody on board it for the entire time, from when the doors close to when the doors open again. Everything's on you, and you take that responsibility, quite rightly, very, very seriously. And I think, yes, the pressure built up over time. I don't think I realised that. And of course, you know, I'm a 51-year-old woman. I hit menopause about the same time.
Doesn't help, does it?
It doesn't help. And it's something that, you know, it's been talked about a lot more recently, but it's something that should be just talked about all the time, because it's going to happen to every woman that you know, or most women that you know will go through it. And I was very lucky to have friends who just said, oh, you know, try HRT, it's nothing to worry about. And that changed my life. But, you know, if I'd have started that a year or two earlier, I may have made a different decision about leaving my job.
Yeah.
By the time I took the decision to go, you know, we'd been through the beginning of this major pandemic that had changed the world. I'd set up a charity that had changed my world, because 6,500 people across the country signed up to support our charity. And we had lounges all over, you know, 104 lounges all over the UK that were looking after NHS frontline staff. And it had changed it changed my perspective on what I wanted from life. And at the end of the day, although I was paid very well for the job I did working for EasyJet, it just became something that I thought, I don't think this is my priority anymore. It's still something that sits in my soul. You know, when you fly, you fly. And my heart is always in the air. But there are other ways that I can support the aviation industry without necessarily being in a flight deck at the moment.
So tell us about Project Windman. That's a mental health awareness charity, is it?
Yeah, so the airlines have peer support systems, and they were brought in as a mandatory requirement just a few years before I ended up leaving EasyJet. And I was one of the first peer mentors at EasyJet. So when we started to go into lockdown, I contacted the guy that oversaw the program for us and said, look, I think there must be a way that we can support NHS staff. We've got thousands of aircrew sitting on the ground wanting to do something. The NHS is facing a huge challenge. I think we can help. And he agreed and introduced me to a captain from BA who was thinking along the same lines. And the two of us had a chat and said, right, well, let's do this. And 3 weeks later, we opened our first lounge at the Whittington Hospital in London. And it was very simple. It was basically provide tea and a listening ear to people who are tired and on their knees and not getting home to see their families and facing a huge amount of uncertainty and terrible challenges. And it was just tea and empathy. Just, we'll sit beside you while you go through this thing. And it just, the first lounge opened 3 weeks after this conversation, and it just dominoed after that all the way through London. We were opening 1 or 2 lounges a week. I think the most we opened in a week was 6 lounges. And then it spread out of London, and my colleague from BA was responsible for London, and I was responsible for not London. And then he left the charity, actually, and that propelled me into the position that I was not really prepared for and had to suddenly learn of CEO of this huge national charity.
Wow, that's incredible.
It was really incredible, and the charity's still going 4 years on. We've had our 4th birthday, we've learned how to twist and turn to change what we offer, so that when challenges come our way, we just adapt and do things differently. So when hospitals needed their spaces back and people started to go back flying again, we bought double-decker buses so that we could still have lounges without taking up spaces inside hospitals and without the need for so many crew. So we have been providing our wellbeing service on board these converted double-decker buses for the last 3 years.
I'm just looking at one now, a lovely blue bus with Project Wingman on the side, and it says Wellbeing on Wheels.
That's us. And we launched on the One Show, actually, and they called us a hug in a mug and described us as being a care bus, not an air bus, which I thought was lovely.
Really, really nice. And it was, of course, so tough for all our medical staff during COVID. But is it still tough for them now we're out the other side then? You still think that they're needing someone to talk to?
100%. I think that we've seen a huge increase in mental health problems in the population generally. I don't know if it's as a result of COVID or if we've just become more aware of it since then. And I think, if anything, the need now is greater than it was at the time, because at the time we all rallied together and said, come on, let's put our best foot forward and support each other and look after each other and do what we can. And now I think, you know, there's a lot of support has gone away from the NHS, because although it's still a fantastic organisation, the public facing front of it, people are waiting a long time for treatment. They don't have, they've lost sympathy really for the NHS, and yet the people who are still working, soldiering on inside the organisation and providing that care, they're getting it on all fronts, because they're working long hours. There's not enough staff. There's a lot of staff who are off long-term sick with either stress or still the effects of long-term COVID. And, you know, the public have stopped clapping for them. And I think that that's hard for people who are working inside the NHS. So there is absolutely still the need. But the long-term solution for NHS wellbeing can't be air crew in uniform, because everyone's gone back to work or found other jobs.
Yeah.
So it's a bigger problem. So we just adapt and continue to support where we can. And, you know, the future for us, we never know what's in the future, because we adapt so often and because we're willing to change and be versatile and flexible. So it's an interesting time to be at the helm of a charity that has done so many great things. And I think right at the moment we are looking back on what we've achieved and really celebrating that. And my second book is going to be telling the Wingman story, but not just through my eyes, but through the eyes of the people who have told me that the charity and what we've done saved them during COVID. And that's medical staff and air crew. Yeah. As well. And when I hear people saying things like that, when you're working in something constantly, you sometimes forget to look at what an amazing thing you've done.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important that we celebrate what happened over the last 4 years and celebrate the commitment that has been shown by people that got out of bed every day, put their uniforms on to go and do something they didn't have to do for people they didn't know. I think that's heroic.
Yes, I agree. And you've obviously personally been recognised with an MBE, and that is for your services to charity, I assume.
That is, absolutely. And that was an incredible surprise. I had an email one day during a meeting, and it was from Downing Street, and I thought I was in trouble. And then I read the email, and I had to close it down and finish the meeting, because I thought, I can't keep a straight face. I can't not say anything about this. And it's very clear that it says you mustn't tell anybody until, you're not allowed to tell anyone until the 30th of December. And I thought, how am I going to keep my mouth shut for that long?
And did you manage to?
Well, I told my husband, because I don't think there's anything that I should keep from him. That's not how we work. But no, I didn't tell anyone else. I didn't even tell my parents. So it was quite a big surprise to everyone when I did let them know. And actually, some of my family found out on the news, because I was on the 10 o'clock news that night. I think they announced it on the 30th at 10 o'clock. And then the list is published on the 31st. And then obviously it's for New Year's Day. And my brother-in-law phoned up at 1 minute past 10 and said, were you going to tell us? And I said, well, yeah, I was just getting round to it. He said, do you know your headline news on BBC? And I said, no, I didn't. And Lewis Hamilton, I think, had got an award as well. But the headline was something like airline pilot lands MBE.
Oh, fantastic. So, fantastic.
It was amazing. And that's really what launched my career as a speaker now, all the interviews and podcasts and things like that I did. And the more I talked about what I'd done, the more people said, oh, that story's really interesting. We'd really like to know more. So that's what led to the career I have now as a professional speaker. But it's also what encouraged me to write the book, because it just gave me an outlet, really. I just put everything down and thought, you know, it may never turn into a book, but I'm just going to write down some of my stories, how I got into flying, some things that happened along the way. Because during my career, I'm very lucky to be here. I nearly died, not in an air crash, but because I was ill. And I was very lucky to survive that. And then after that, I rushed back into trying to do things too quickly. And I failed my first attempt at becoming a captain.
Oh, no.
And in an industry that is full of men, there's only 5% of the world's pilots are women. Only 3% of commercial pilots are women. And there are fewer than 500 female airline captains in the world. So there's not very many of us. And it's a world where people don't talk about failure and the things they've got wrong. It's very kind of, everybody always wants to celebrate the wins all the time. And nobody really wants to talk about the things they got wrong. And I did. I just said to people, you know, learn from my mistakes. Don't do this. Don't do it my way. And a year later, I successfully got my command and became a captain and spent the next few years happily flying around Europe.
And this all started in New Zealand.
Well, it all started on the runway at Stansted, really, when I was that space shuttle. Yeah. I've never been in space, and neither has that air shuttle, because
there's
it was
still
a
time. Well, I could honestly speak to you all day, Emma, but sadly we're out of time. So I'll just let all our listeners know that the book's called Grounded. It's by Emma Henderson, MBE, who we're chatting to now. Now, I know that there is a Project Wingman website, projectwingman.co.uk. Is there an Emma Henderson one as well?
There absolutely is. I am at emma-henderson.com. And the book is available on Amazon, but you can get a signed copy if you go to emma-henderson.com/services, and you will find my book there.
Wonderful. Well, well done on all your achievements, and thank you so much for sharing them with us on today's show.
Well, thank you. It's been lovely chatting to you.
Lovely chatting to you. You too. Thanks, Emma. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.